You know, today's sermon was sort of hard to, it had an interesting journey coming to fruition because it started out that I was going to preach from these words that are sort of confusing and dismal sounding and then turn it into something perhaps a little more lighthearted and easy to easily accessible, sort of a feel-good sermon I wanted to preach. And then something happened in Charlottesville that didn't feel very good. And I felt like I had to respond to that. But I didn't think I could write a whole sermon, so I tried to weave thoughts about Charlottesville into a feel-good sermon. That wasn't so easy, but giving it a go anyway. It ended up being kind of a long sermon, so sit tight. This morning's lesson from Paul's letter to the Romans contains a lot of words that that can feel hard to hear, right? Words like sin, death, and condemnation. And originally, I was going to start the sermon by inviting you to ignore all of those difficult words in favor of listening for a deeper message. And I'm going to get to that deeper message in a bit because it is actually a joyful and powerful deeper message of inclusion and of universal salvation. It is good news and it is surprising news if, like me, you have come to think of Paul as being the early church bad boy, the guy who was in charge of adding ugliness to the beauty of Jesus' message. Well, it turns out Paul really isn't all bad. And we're going to talk about that later in the sermon, but I feel as if I need to start my sermon by addressing what has transpired over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a group of white supremacists, including neo-Nazis and armed militia and the Ku Klux Klan and a motley assemblage of alt-right and fascist groups, came together to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. On Friday night, this hateful band marched through Charlottesville with torches, and they managed to look menacing and scary despite the fact that the torches were mostly tiki torches they bought at a gardening store. And then yesterday, there were more protests, and there were counter-protests to the racist posturing, and the racists turned violence. They turned to violence and terrorism and eventually to murder when a white nationalist drove his car into a crowd of anti-racist demonstrators, killing a young woman and injuring several other folks. And our president, depressingly, if not surprisingly, failed to condemn the racism, blaming the mess on extremism on what he called many sides, as if there's no difference between racism and those who speak against it, as if there's actually are many sides on the issue of racism rather than a simple question of right and wrong. All of which has led me to abandon my initial plan to invite you to ignore words like sin and condemnation and death. You know, Donald Trump doesn't think he needs to ask God for forgiveness. But as far as I can tell, the racism and violence and terrorism on display over the weekend is a reminder that we still need words like sin and condemnation. And Donald Trump needs to seek forgiveness for his inability to condemn a movement, his rise to power, help to invigorate. But here's the thing, it's not just Donald Trump. And it's not just the vile slice of humanity that showed up to march on the streets of Charlottesville with their swastikas, tiki torches, and guns and hate. We live in a democracy in which free speech is guaranteed, which means that any one of us who does not take advantage of that free speech, any one of us who has remained silent in the face of hatred, any one of us who has urged moderation when confronting racism, any one of us who has supported a politics of getting along and not making waves, any one of us who furthers the racial divide in America by avoiding certain neighborhoods in our city, or by keeping a homogenous circle of friends, which is to say pretty much all of us, especially if we're white and educated, we all need to engage in a process of self-reflection when it comes to racism. We all need to acknowledge our sin. But of course, the Christian faith does not allow sin to have the final word. According to the Christian tradition, articulated by Paul, we are saved by grace, and it is God's grace that has the final word, and we are welcomed, each one of us, into a beloved community. And we're not just welcomed. We are valued as equals in the kingdom of God. And that makes Paul's ideas about sin and redemption and transformation, it makes those ideas about God's grace entirely antithetical to the program of white supremacy that we saw in Charlottesville this weekend. Now, I'm going to go back to my original sermon for a while, which I had intended to be sort of lighthearted. In fact, I'm going to sing a song in a little bit for you. It's a song called Beer with Jesus, for crying out loud. But before I do, I want to talk a little bit more about the passage from Romans that Cheryl read to us. As I acknowledged earlier, the passage contains a lot of words and ideas that may do a good job of describing the horrific display of hate in Charlottesville. But at first, these words also seem to be advocating the kind of abusive religion that a lot of us came to Montclair Presbyterian Church in an effort to escape. The passage fairly drips with words like sin and death and condemnation. And besides that, these words come from the pen of the Apostle Paul. And he's a problem. Most of the parts of the New Testament that make us go, yuck, were written by or ascribed to the Apostle Paul. But here's a little secret. A little secret that they may not have told you in progressive school. Paul can be kind of awesome too. And underneath the kind of dark and somewhat goth language of this evening's lesson, there is a bit of surprising awesomeness that I want to share with you. You know, as someone who grew up informed by and later was trained in a sort of gentle evangelicalism, when I give this passage a cursory reading, it sounds like something that would confirm the notion that Paul's writings are to be avoided by anyone whose faith has half a heart and a fraction of a soul. Paul is articulating his ideas that humans are sinners and deserving of eternal death, but are saved by Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. This doctrine, at least the first part of it, has been used by the practitioners of toxic faith to wound souls for generations. Now, I happen to think there are ways in which Paul's doctrine of sin and redemption can be, well, redeemed, especially when I hear of the news coming out of Virginia right now, to say nothing of the possibility that both Guam and Pyongyang might be vaporized in a pair of competing nuclear flashes. Human sin feels oddly real right now to me. But that's a subject for another sermon, or perhaps you can come to my Bible study Wednesdays at noon. We're talking about the book of Romans and about this stuff. But for now, I'd like to point out a couple of things about this passage, wonderful things, usually overlooked by the practitioners of toxic faith. First, in this passage, Paul is advocating for universal salvation, meaning that everybody gets saved, everybody goes to heaven. The hell you say, I hear both my evangelical and progressive friends protest. Paul was about exclusion, they say. Only Christians and only Paul's kind of Christian are saved, according to Paul's version of Christianity. To which I say, dearly beloved, read this evening's lesson with a little more attention. In this lesson, Paul suggests that Adam is responsible for original sin and Jesus gets credit for universal salvation. The way Paul talks about Jesus' salvation is identical to the way Paul talks about Adam's sin. Thanks to Adam, everyone sins. Thanks to Jesus, everyone is saved. Paul is saying that Jesus' salvation extends as far as Adam's sin, which is to say it is universal. So that's one thing, a reason to reconsider Paul. Do you like that? Yes. The other thing is maybe a little deeper, but it's similar. Paul wrote Romans as a way of trying to heal the rift between Jewish and non-Jewish Christians in the first century church. As you may know, Jesus and all of his followers and all the earliest Christians were Jewish, and Christianity started out as a Jewish sect. But thanks to Paul and to Peter and to others, non-Jews started joining the Christian church within a few decades of the start of the church, and the population of Gentile Christians grew fairly quickly, and as a result, the church had to figure out how to include both Jewish and non-Jewish Christians. And Paul's contribution to that conversation, and it's an idea that in the end took hold, was to say that whether you are Jewish or not, the same rules and spiritual principles apply. And for Paul, that meant we all sin equally, and we all are redeemed equally, and we all have the same requirements for Christian living. We are all the same in God's eyes. And that equality before God, of course, is lovely, but Paul does more than just say that both Jews and Greeks are welcome in the church. He goes further by incorporating ideas from Judaism and from Greco-Roman paganism into the articulation of his Christian doctrine. Today's lesson is a really good example of this. In the passage, Paul starts with a Jewish idea. Adam, the first man, brought the curse of sin into the world. This is found in Genesis. And by saying that Jesus is the new Adam who brings life, Paul is placing Jesus squarely within his own Jewish tradition. But then Paul goes on to say that in baptism, and for Paul, baptism would have meant full immersion, underwater baptism, like the Baptists do. In baptism, we join with Jesus in his journey through death and resurrection. We go underwater and die with Christ, and we come up from the water, and we are raised with Christ to new life. We are crucified with Christ, we enter into his death, we share in his glory. Now here, Paul is articulating the Christian faith as a mythic journey, which to me, though admittedly I'm not a real expert on this, but to me, this sounds an awful lot like a spirituality that has been informed by the myth of Persephone, or by the myth of Osiris's journey through the underworld. A god has died and has been resurrected, and we share in that journey through death into new life. This is not Jewish. This is paganism. And Paul, in the book of Romans, welcomes both Jews and pagans into the Christian faith by articulating his ideas about salvation, first using Jewish images and then using pagan images. Now, if my reading of Paul is correct, then it turns out that from the very beginning, the Christian faith has been informed by a variety of religious traditions. And the question that we need to ask is this: should we limit that outside input into those religious traditions? Should we limit that outside input from religious traditions to those religious traditions that were active 2,000 years ago in the Mediterranean? Or does the principle still apply so that we can be informed by non-Christian ideas even today? Now, I believe the latter, and to be honest, sometimes I find it easier to be informed by Buddhism or Islam or than by other Christians. Let me say that again, because I goofed it up. Sometimes I find it easier to be informed by Buddhism or Islam than by other Christians. And sometimes I'm surprised when I am moved by your average white American megachurch attending Protestant Christian. Which, guess what? It turns out that God is alive among Christians who are not like us. And we can learn from Christians who are not like us. And that leads me to the song that I want to sing, and Talitha is going to help me, and I want to introduce that song by saying that when I first heard that there was a song out there called Beer with Jesus, I wanted to buy a copy of the song because I figured it would be a musical version of Jesus Junk. And that's a genre of kitsch that you can pick up at Bible bookstores. Like the Jesus belt buckle I used to wear without irony as a child, or the golf balls that say, I once was lost but now I'm found on them, or the Altoid knockoffs called Testa Mints, or a good old-fashioned dashboard Jesus. I confess I love Jesus Junk, and that's why I downloaded Beer with Jesus. Before I even got a chance to listen to the song, I just knew that it would make me laugh in a sort of elitist, spiritually informed, Princeton Seminary educated sort of way. After all, this was a song straight out of Nashville, and I really do like country music, but I'm more Austin than Nashville. For me, listening to Willie Nelson is a transcendent experience, even when he's singing Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die. But Nashville, with its over-engineered recordings, its glitter, its barely sublimated jingoism, its forced southern accents, it's always been something of a turnoff to me. To quote a country song made famous by another great Texas band, the Dixie Chicks, when it comes to Nashville music, I tend to agree that they sound tired, but they don't sound haggard. They got money, but they don't have cash. They've got Junior, but they don't got Hank, I think. So I bought and downloaded Thomas Rhett's song, Beer with Jesus, and I expected to laugh, but instead I found myself moved by the song. I mean, it's a silly premise, having a beer with Jesus, but the song ends up being filled with earnest and genuine questions and longings. They're not always my questions and longings, but I recognize and respect and find myself moved by the honesty of the song. And Talitha and I are going to sing that song for you now. Thank you. So here's what I want to say. This is the point of my sermon as I wrote it Friday morning. If Christianity can be informed not just by the Judaism out of which it was born, but also by the paganism of its early non-Jewish adherents, if modern spirituality can be formed not just by high-minded intellectualism, but also by Nashville pop country, then for heaven's sake, there is room in Christianity for you. And not just you as you will become, but you as you are now. There is room for you not just because you can receive the gift of a great tradition, but there is room for you because of what you can bring to help build a tradition that will be passed on to generations yet unborn. There is room for you if you are a lifelong passionate believer. There is room for you if you're an agnostic or an atheist. There is room for you if your faith is informed by Buddhism or Judaism or Islam or Wicca or whatever. Just come. Join the band of those who would follow Jesus. Come and be woven into the fabric of the Christian faith. Never allow your doubts or your reservations fool you into thinking that the threads of your spirit are unworthy or are unwanted in the cloth that the great weaver is fabricating, a cloth that is made beautiful because it is made of many threads with many colors and many textures, a cloth that will be even more wonderful because you have been woven into it. Now, we have reached the end of the sermon I wrote on Friday morning, but it feels important to revisit once more the subject of the racist hatred that showed up in force in Charlottesville this weekend and that has made an appearance in Berkeley and that could rear its head in just about any town in America right now. We are at our best when we look exactly unlike the folks who showed up with their torches in Virginia on Friday night and who marched through those same streets on Saturday. We need to be at our best. And Paul gave us faith-based language that can help us be at our best. He did this by envisioning Christianity as a religion that welcomes and values and incorporates all sorts of people. Right now, we cannot look to the president to lead us to be at our best. Our political system is broken such that even decent and well-meaning politicians have little power to change things, and the media cannot seem to lead us along paths of righteousness either. But we cannot let the lack of national leadership stop us from being a beloved community, the beloved community God calls us to be. We need to be our best. We need to be the most loving, most righteous people we can be. And by God's grace, such transformation is indeed possible. So let us refuse not to be our best. Let us refuse not to be people of faith trying to be faithful. Let us refuse to be anything but a people who with joy and hope celebrates the goodness of all God's beautiful children. Let us refuse to allow hate to have the last word. Let us live together in the beauty of God's grace.